Mark Devenport, our political editor, is with us this morning. On your day off, Mr. Devenport?
I'm on a bit of a day off, yes. Yeah, trying to keep a low profile, just coming on, you know, a low profile programme like yours.
You're never on a day off when the Nolan Show has a hotline to your private number, Mark.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, I just heard you talking there about the unexplained wealth orders, and it reminded me, actually, of a conversation that we had back in late October, because it was actually yourself who obtained an early copy of the Paramilitary Crime Task Force report.
Do you remember that? I remember that.
And just around that time, and you were kind enough to share it with me, and I was flicking through it. Just around that time, of course, there was a story in the news about how the police in England were using these unexplained wealth orders to try and crack down on organised crime. And one of the big stories was that they had used it in the case of an Azerbaijani woman who went on a £16 million shopping spree in Harrods and couldn't explain where she got all the wealth from. So it was interesting then that when I looked at your Paramilitary Crime Task Force report, that they definitely had a section in there in which they said that this would be a good tool for the police to use, for the justice authorities to use, but it's one of those things that can't be brought in unless the Assembly comes back.
And this is where, Mr. Devenport, I need your brain, which is a lot bigger than mine.
You're flattering me there.
and here's why. So what I don't understand is, okay, when I hear commentators or correspondents like yourself and others say, look, we need an assembly, we need a minister to be able to do this, okay? I am now totally confused as to what type of instances do we need a minister? I thought Cam Bradley had given the civil service more power. So what now distinguishes what the civil service can and cannot do? And if the civil servants can't do it, why can Karen Bradley not ultimately, if she wants to, try to change legislation through the House of Commons so that it can be brought into Northern Ireland in the absence of a devolved assembly?
Well, I suppose what that legislation is intended to do is allow the civil servants to tick over, if you like, and to make decisions that don't require new laws, but it doesn't allow them particularly to bring forth new legislation. So you're right, if something like an unexplained wealth order was to be brought into force, then Karen Bradley would have to do it. But at the moment, she and the Northern Ireland office are saying, look, justice, like other matters, is devolved. There were a lot of negotiations that went on before its devolution. I'm not prepared to step in and spoil the balance.
Okay, so I understand that. So Mark, it's not that they can't do it, it's that they're choosing not to do it.
Yeah, because in certain areas, I mean, obviously we have a budget now which has been passed through Westminster and she's decided to do that. She's decided, for instance, to extend the scheme, which means that some of the bigger payouts that were due to be made under the renewable heat incentive won't be made. So she's decided that that's a necessary thing to do. But she's not getting in, and it's not just obviously the unexplained wealth orders. There's all sorts of things. I actually haven't. In a different capacity to be attending a conference today that's to do with domestic and sexual violence. And you'll know that there's various laws there in relation to coercive control that they have across in other parts of the UK, but which they haven't brought in here. So, you know, there's a whole number of areas where she won't move in. And there's an interesting case study that's obviously going to come up, which is that at the moment we're having a consultation about the whole scheme to give compensation to survivors of historic institutional abuse. And we've got the head of the civil service saying, look, if Stormont's not back by the time that consultation ends in about 10 weeks' time, then Karen Bradley should go ahead and move the law on. And she's saying, no, that's a matter for Stormont. So once again, I think paramilitarism, like so many other areas of the law or so many other areas of policy, is still caught in this table tennis match where the ping-pong ball is Northern Ireland society, and it's been sort of the past between the local politicians and the Northern Ireland office.
But surely it's at least a fair question that they can't have it both ways, that if we have, from the Prime Minister down, reassuring people in Northern Ireland that we are part of the United Kingdom, unless, obviously, through any type of poll, it's decided otherwise, then why do we just take it as read that, oh, we need a minister back to do that? Why shouldn't Karen Bradley, the Secretary of State, care enough about Northern Ireland that if we do need a piece of legislation to tackle gangsterism and paramilitarism and it's very important that we do that in Northern Ireland, isn't it? Why shouldn't she care enough to actually do it? Why should there be this waiting game, this standoff? Do the people of Northern Ireland not deserve a British government to be implementing legislation when it is necessary to do it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an argument that could be made that, you know, the standoff has now gone on so long at Stormont that there's a whole host of areas in which you can make an entirely legitimate argument that the government should move in. And, you know, we're seeing, not just in relation to paramilitarism, we're seeing, you know, school budgets in the red and so on, and would direct rule be a better way of administering these things? But so far, of course, the position of the UK government is that they want to take as little an interventionist stance as possible in Northern Ireland. They want to kind of preserve things, if you like, frozen in aspic, in the hope that they can get Stormont back together. It becomes less credible as time has gone on, but I think the political reality is that they're entirely focused on Brexit, they're juggling with those matters, and that the Northern Ireland office is really, you know, it used to be something that the paramilitaries used to say, whatever you say, say nothing. Well, it looks like the Northern Ireland office is operating on whatever you do, do nothing.
Mark, thanks very much indeed. Thank you. Do you know what I want to do, actually, if we can? I want to spend another few minutes on this, and we'll push other stuff back to 10 o'clock if we can. I don't know if we can or we can't. Because I think the there is territory for us all to discuss here of these unexplained wealth orders. And here's what's in my head. So they exist in England, right? They were actually brought in, passed in Westminster, and brought in under the Criminal Finances Act 2017 because they wanted to tackle gangsters in England. Are we seriously going to leave ourselves in a situation in Northern Ireland where we have these paramilitaries who have a lifetime's experience of intimidating people, burning people out of their homes, collecting protection money from people that are just trying to keep businesses afloat, and there's nobody going to make it happen here? Are we really that weak and impotent in Northern Ireland that nobody can make it happen here? From the Secretary of State, Karen Bradley, to, I don't know, the MPs in Westminster lobbying someone that it needs to be brought in here now, not waiting for some never, never day in the future. Our Ireland correspondent, Emma Vardy, has a lot of knowledge around this. Thanks for coming on this morning, Emma. Good morning.
Hi.
And you did quite a lot of work on these when you were in London, right?
I did. And in London, there's a lot of appetite to tackle corrupt wealth in London. So we think of things like rich Russian oligarchs using corrupt money to live lavish lifestyles, very much like the case Mark Devenport mentioned there with the shopping spree at Harrods. But these are maybe people who in their home countries live on a very modest wage. Perhaps they are low-paid civil servants. And therefore, you can't explain why they have a beautiful flat in Chelsea, for example, and unexplained wealth orders place the burden of proof on them to prove where they got the money from.
And so are they effective? They haven't been used that often across the world. Is it once they've been used?
I don't know the exact numbers, but I know it's pretty low. And that recent case of the Harrods spree.
Sure. I think that might have been the first one, I think.
Yeah, we'll check that out. This is a problem because, you know, anti-corruption campaigners are pushing very hard for the National Crime Agency to use these unexplained wealth orders more, saying that they are a good measure, they've got teeth. You know, there's campaigners out there who will give you a list of, like, these are the people we think you should target. In fact, in London, you can actually go on a tour, an anti-corruption tour, where they take you round beautiful properties and go, that belongs to somebody who we believe, you know, back in their home country, they couldn't possibly afford this mansion in very warm London. So, but the thing is that the National Crime Agency has been, if you like, somewhat slow in some people's opinion to use these orders because in some ways, like anything in legal systems, in the courts, it's not as easy as it seems on paper. You know, of course, you still need the evidence, you still need proof, but it does shift the balance. So if you look at the paramilitaries in Northern Ireland, what this power would do is instead of having to already convict somebody and prove that they were a member of a organisation or prove that they had carried out some sort of crime and then hit them in the pocket, this shifts the balance of proof. And before you've, what you do is you then you require them to explain where they got their funds from, if they're living on a modest wage, but as you said before, living in a very nice house, driving a very fancy car.
So I dare say there would be a very significant majority of decent law-abiding people listening to this morning saying, we need this in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I think you're right. It would be very popular. And certainly when I was speaking to the TSNI and the National Crime Agency in Northern Ireland, they said this is top of their list. If you've got an executive back tomorrow, this would be top of their list. Pass the legislation. There's not going to be much opposition to it. And it's another tool in their armoury for being able to allow them to tackle paramilitaries. Because perhaps you can't catch the bosses of organisations with the guns or with the Semtex or actually carrying out a so-called punishment attack themselves. But what you can do is you hit them in the pocket, because, of course, there are maybe youngsters, other people in the community who look up to bosses of organised crime groups because they live these lifestyles and it becomes an aspiration, you know, something they may want to become part of. But if you can take that car away, take the Rolex, you know, they're no longer going on the nice holiday. Yeah. It kind of de-glamorises it.
Do you know what? It's such an obviously good idea that would benefit Northern Ireland so much that no doubt it won't happen. Emma, you've been really helpful to us today. Thank you very much indeed. That's our Ireland correspondent, Emma Vardy. Sorry, could someone please tell me how it's impossible to have this in Northern Ireland soon rather than waiting for an executive? Maybe it is too good an idea. Look, I want to roll this morning, if you don't mind, with this unexplained wealth order. I'm smiling to myself because if you mind or not, I'm going to do it. But I think it's really important, actually. And I think our Ireland correspondent, Emma Vardy, there actually brought us a very interesting, certainly I hadn't heard it before, piece of information that Emma has said that during her discussions with the PSNI and the National Crime Agency, that they have told her that an unexplained wealth order in Northern Ireland would be at the top of their wish list. Now, we'll try to explore that ourselves with the PSNI after the show today. I think this is really important for this reason, that when we talk about paramilitaries in Northern Ireland, we often collectively in the phone-in together, we kind of get to a point where we all know, well, it's really difficult to hurt these people. It's really difficult to legally take them down because the police need evidence. Here's a piece of legislation which Emma was explaining to us. The background is that they've brought it in London. They brought it in England. In London, it's hoped that they'll be used to tackle corrupt Russian oligarchs. So a situation now here in Northern Ireland where if we had these unexplained wealth orders, then this could be a very strong piece of our weaponry, of our ammunition against these thugs who intimidate, who destroy lives, who destroy property. And are we really going to sit back and say, well, we need a government up and going in Northern Ireland before that comes in? Because that's not technically true. It could be brought in if the Secretary of State wanted it to happen, or maybe if there are other ways of doing it. Now, let me just explain to you what an unexplained wealth order actually is. It's a new power. It's been designed to target suspected corrupt foreign officials who have been potentially laundered stolen money through the UK. Well, that's interesting. So could it only target foreign officials? I doubt it. Investigators from the National Crime Agency believe there are billions of pounds of dirty money invested in British property. It's almost impossible to charge the owners with a crime or seize the assets because of a lack of evidence. The new unexplained wealth orders are an attempt to force the owners to disclose their wealth. If a suspected corrupt foreign official or their family cannot show a legitimate source for their riches, then the National Crime Agency can apply to the High Court to seize the property. So that's the context within which it's going to be used, among other things, across the water. But we often, when we say to ourselves, how can we have the paramilitaries of Northern Ireland on the run? Well, just imagine them having to prove where they get their money from or they lose it. Would that not actually give us all a smile, a big smile in the morning? And then that nugget that our Ireland correspondent Emma Vardy has given us today, that the PSNI and the National Crime Agency have told her that this would be at the top of their list in Northern Ireland. So why can't we make it happen? Why not? Why is it always a situation in Northern Ireland where there's a stumbling block or there's a hurdle or there's a reason why something can't happen? Now, Alan McQuillan was a former Assistant Chief Constable. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning.
How effective would this be?
It could be extremely effective if it was used. And I mean, one of the ways to get at these organisations is to, if you can't arrest them, can't charge them, can't prosecute them, to seize their assets and make it unprofitable. And it's interesting we're talking about this year because this is the 10th anniversary of the abolition of the Assets Recovery Agency. And we were told that when ARRA was abolished, that these things were going to be done with a serious and organised crime agency and there was going to be lots of activity. And the reality is nothing happened.
You headed up that asset recovery agency, didn't you?
I did. And at the end, I was assured when we were transferring it over that there would be action. And there wasn't. Indeed, there were some cases that were in action by asset recovery agency that were stopped by SOCA because they said they didn't fit their criteria. So they abandoned them. And basically, they, to a large extent, we walked away, the government walked away from asset recovery in Northern Ireland. And none of the political parties complained about that because, in many cases, the people who were being pursued were their clients, frankly. So, in these circumstances...
Whose clients?
Well, I think the political parties, they saw themselves as representing the two communities.
Well, now that's... You know, we need to be very careful, Alan, don't we? Like, really, really careful. We have no evidence of that whatsoever, and I would distance myself from that. And we would want to talk to you behind the scenes before we would even go close to disputing that.
Let me be absolutely clear. What I'm saying here is, we have a politic based on communities, two separate communities, and if you're doing something against ours. If you're doing something against theirs, that's fine. If you're doing something against ours, we want to see that it's balanced between the two. And the bottom line is, we were promised there was going to be action. There was no action. So you have to look and say, why? And frankly, if we had the Northern Ireland Assembly up and running again tomorrow morning, the chances that these powers would be introduced to Northern Ireland, in my view, are absolutely zero. It would take 15 years of negotiation between the two parties.
In terms of the Assets Recovery Agency that you used to head up, doesn't exist in Northern Ireland anymore, did you have to have a crime that had been proven and the court process had concluded before you could seize the assets?
No, it was more complex than that. You had to have evidence that the assets came from criminal activity or lawful activity, and that could be crime or it could be tax evasion. And very often, when we couldn't prove the connection to a crime, we could still prove that the individuals had assets that they couldn't account for.
Okay.
We could have the party interview them and require them to explain how they came by those assets. And very often we went after them for tax fraud rather than the original crime where we couldn't prove where the money came from.
Okay.
They couldn't account for it. We went on tax fraud.
So I get it, right? So I get it. But actually, these unexplained wealth orders, they're better than that again.
Yes,
because the onus was on you in the past to prove the tax fraud, to prove some type of crime. In these unexplained wealth orders, the state doesn't need to prove anything. These gangsters have got to prove where they're getting their money from. So if they are driving around in a big flash car, they've got to say to us, the public, they've got it through the authorities. They've got to say, well, here's how I legitimately earned the money to buy my top-of-the-range car.
I agree completely.
Well, is that not incredible? And would that not be an incredible piece of power in Northern Ireland?
It's an extremely powerful order now. It's quite expensive.
And yet we don't have it.
The High Court, but yes, we don't do it. We don't have it. I mean, a lot of the developments in the UK criminal justice field over the last 10 to 15 years have never been picked up in Northern Ireland. They haven't been, and that's, you know, that's not the the fault of ministers of justice, perhaps, but if you remember the various arguments we had over who would be the Minister of Justice, and then Alliance took it on. But you know, when you're not one of the two big parties and you were sitting as a minister, there must have been extremely difficult.
You see,
you weren't the priority.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm going down, and if you want to participate in this conversation, I do think this is really important. 03030 80 55 55. Here's the route I'm going down this morning, Alan. On other days, of course, there's a very legitimate discussion to be constantly had in Northern Ireland, actually, about the benefits of a Northern Ireland Assembly. All right? But I'm going to park that debate this morning. Why don't we have a discussion in Northern Ireland rather than no can do? This can be done without a government. Why aren't we doing it? So it literally can be done without the Northern Ireland Assembly. So the discussion now, why isn't it being done? We've got people being burnt out. We've got businesses across the country being extorted for thousands of pounds. There is the ability to bring in legislation that would make those thugs that collect that money prove that they've done so legitimately. They wouldn't be able to do it, and we would have the upper hand. Why aren't we doing it? Can you guess, Alan, why we're not doing it?
I think there's several reasons. First of all, there's no political pressure to do it. And secondly, there's actually, in my view, probably the reverse of that, because I think there were agreements reached with various parties in St Andrews and other agreements which mitigate against it, unless the Northern Ireland Assembly does it. So unless it's a political issue, and unless it is resolved politically, it will be done. And I do not see the Northern Ireland office doing anything to forward this at the moment, no matter what happens.
Well, we should stop saying then in Northern Ireland, we should stop saying that nothing can be done, because here's something where I think it's very obvious something can be done. And for every single week that goes on, where throughout the country people are walking in and walking out again with a brown envelope of dirty money going to a dirty cause, and we're kind of watching this happen in front of us, knowing that meanwhile across the water in England, Russian oligarchs can be pursued through this, but we can't pursue our local gangsters. Like, what does that say? Stephen and Antrim, morning.
Oh, how's it going? I just rang in to say that I think it'll be like it was before, you know, years ago there, where, you know, these people will try and do their jobs, you know, and they'll be looking into these people and their life will be under threat. You know, that's the way these people work. You know, they want to get it so bad that they're willing to threaten people's lives for it, you know.
Stephen, that's, so I'm not sure if you've missed the point here this morning, which is you wouldn't then need evidence from individual business owners who have been intimidated, individual members of the public. You wouldn't need it. Because what this wealth order would be is the police, the power would be with the police. The police would go to these people and make them prove where they got their money from. They can't prove where they get their money from, then they lose their assets.
I know, but there's still no-go areas in Northern Ireland at the minute. You know, where the police still can't go, or they won't go, you know. And I think I support the thing. You know, I am happy. I'd be more than happy for the people there who don't deserve the things that they've caught to lose them. But I just don't think it's going to work.
As a former senior police officer, Alan, do you agree with Stephen? Are there still no-go areas?
I don't think there are no-go areas anymore, far from it. But I think in terms of the physical presence on the ground, I think there are still
areas where there is a desire, not in the path of the police and security security agencies, but there's still areas where there is a desire not to rock the boat too hard on behalf of government.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that they're desperate to get a political settlement and they don't want to do anything, in my assessment, this is my personal assessment, Stephen, they don't want to do anything that will upset those where it might cause political problems, or security problems.
Well, if you look at George Hamilton's past, he has rocked many boats, hasn't he? And very much on those occasions, I don't think that it has been politically expedient for him to do so, and George Hamilton has still done it.
Stephen, let me be absolutely clear. I'm not criticizing PSNI. I'm not saying that PSNI are doing this. What I'm saying is that government is doing this. Not PSNI, government.
Alan, thank you. Morning to you. Thanks for coming on today. Mark in Belfast. Morning, Mark.
Hey, Dan, Stephen. Just wondering, is it going to be selective for paramilitaries, or would you advocate it for everybody who has more money than they declare that they earn? And I know someone who would be in an adult entertainment industry who lives a really good life, but she does no one no harm. And because the industry she's in, technically she can't say, I do this for a living, or otherwise she'd be breaking the law. Is it those people as well you're looking to chase down, or, you know?
Well, look for others to decide, Mark, what we're talking about today is in the context of, we've done a story at the top of the show, okay, of how paramilitaries are suspected of burning, you know, a man's business out twice, all right?
Yes,
so,
I understand.
So that's why we're talking about paramilitaries. And all I'm saying this morning, Mark, is we've talked before to business owners who say, you know, every week people walk in and they walk out again with a wad of money and they're frightened of coming forward with evidence. So why
would you only use it on people that you don't like, or would you use it against everybody who has more money than they declare to earn?
Well,
or just about the people that you don't like?
Well, there's an inference there that there's it's questionable as to why I don't like paramilitaries. Do you like them?
No.
Right. So what's your problem?
I have no problem. I'm asking you, would it be selective to the people that you think it should be used against? Or should it be used against everybody who has £1,000 more each year than they actually declared it a tax man?
Well, that's a decision for the authorities, isn't it?
I'm only asking your personal opinion on it, but not the authorities, yours. You raised the subject.
If someone's breaking the law, then you would hope that the if the state has
powers... anyone who has a penny declared to the Inland Revenue is breaking the law. That's what I'm asking you.
Why do you not want to focus on the paramilitaries here?
I'm asking you, are you going to focus on everybody? Or are you going
not to
be...
Not today, because we're talking about paramilitaries, but on another day, of course, we could talk about other people who are breaking the law who could get caught up in this. But we're talking here, Mark, about, you know, we've been talking in general about how do we give us, law-abiding people, the upper hand against gangsters who put masks on in the middle of the night
and
burn
is,
people out.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is, it's what you determine is what is law abiding. Lots of people in this entire country consider themselves to be law abiding, but they actually are bending rules and regulations. And what are rules and regulations? They are laws of the land.
Yeah.
And I certainly bend them sometimes, and I consider myself to be a reasonably decent person. But then again, that's where I'm asking you, do you split hers, or is it just about people
I think,
do you think lead a bad life, or is it against everybody that bends
okay,
the
rules? Right. So let's just state the obvious here, all right? It's not about... First of all, there's merit in what you're talking about, okay? Absolutely. Of course there is. It's not about people who I deem to be leading a bad life. You know, we're not talking about some type of subjective... moral dilemma here. We're talking about people, Mark, who go out and set fire to businesses and intimidate and threaten to kill
people.
That's
what you would cure with it in the instant when it comes in.
Yeah.
And then there's someone else, not you in particular, but there's someone else look down at me, because I work in a cash industry where I earn every penny I earn in cash.
Yep.
So therefore, I might not and then again I might declare 100% of my earnings, but maybe I can't afford to in some years. And there's some people will call that tax evasion. Some people that are rich and work within famous industries like yourself might call it tax diversion. I don't know, or you know, certain other words for it.
Yeah.
But do people look down at me then and say, you're a criminal, you're breaking the law, we're going to hunt you down? I don't know, are they? I work hard for every penny I get. But, you know, that's what I'm asking you. Where do you draw the line as to who's a criminal?
Well, I think,
you know, in your mind and in the public's mind.
Well, look, it's, you know,
because in the law's mind, it's straightforward. If you break the law, you break the law.
Look, if you're not paying all your tax, right?
You're breaking the law.
You're breaking the law. Of course you are. And I think what happens is that if they come after you and they can prove you've broken the law, then they have the option of taking a criminal option against you, HMRC. Yep. That's enshrined in legislation now, right?
Yep.
And if they do that, I think there is an ability to seize then assets if you've benefited from your criminal activity. So I think that still exists.
So if a working man like me or anybody up the street or anybody in this country is not declaring a couple of £1,000 a year to try and help themselves pay a mortgage or whatever the case may be, or raise their kids, this law could then, and this is where I'm saying you have to be careful, it could then allow a taxman to come along or the police to say, he spends more than he earns on paper, let's repossess his house off and sell it at auction and stick him into a flat somewhere unsavoury and live amongst these people that you're trying to target. This is what I'm saying, the laws, they're great, but you got to be careful sometimes the where you draw the line, because many people will live in this country and consider themselves to be decent people, but they might well break a law.
Yeah, and I get your point, and it's an argument well made. All I would say back to you is this legislation is in place in England, and you haven't seen too many people for tax getting done by it, all right? But thank you, Mark. Thank you for your call. Good call.